Very happy to be back at Stanford again, and intriguing breaking out of the matrix of illusion. It's hard for people to admit that they may be in illusion. On an individual and mass level, then naturally we ask, well, what kind of illusion? I seem to be in a way that is realistic, meaning it works for my life. So how could it be that I'm in illusion and society is in illusion? The standpoint of crisis. Crisis is nothing exotic these days. It's a word that's a situation, as well as the classic multifaceted yoga handbook, Bhagavad Gita, which is the situation we have now. We'll do a quick environmental scan, and then later we'll do an internal scan of what may be going on inside of us. Always nice to reconsider these points. The equivalent of 7 New York cities is added to the world's population. Now, 2 centuries ago, if somehow or other you got to outer space of glowing light indicating populations over 1 million, 200 years ago that would have just been London and Beijing. Spots of light indicating such a population over 1 million. Now you have 450 bright spots of light if you could see from outer space. So we have to consider the quality of the human beings and not simply the quantity, especially since, as you know, expected to reach 9 billion. That means the equivalent of 2 Chinas is going to be added to the world's population. So intelligent resource is going to come from, and where is the space to dispose of the waste? So we have some challenges to deal with. You might focus on just one challenge. Let's say climate change. But actually, I'd like you to consider that whether the challenge you'd like to focus on, and indeed you could have a whole academic career just picking out one crisis of the many available today, you could have an entire technological, scientific career just isolating one challenge, but I would like to present to you that our humanity's greatest challenge is not simply climate change or pandemics or nuclear proliferation, not even water scarcity, not the Middle East. Our greatest challenge is that our institutions can't resolve any of these challenges. This is the greatest challenge. So, not simply can our institutions not solve these challenges, but it seems that they cannot even prioritize challenges. So, until we address the failure of our institutions to resolve the significant challenges we face, obviously we can't expect any progress in dealing with these challenges. If you just look at climate change, for example, is it just a scientific issue? No. Many are saying that you're actually dealing with a political and economic social problem. You're dealing with the symptom of dysfunctional behavior on the individual and social level, dysfunctional social and economic practices and policies. So many are now realizing it would be good to shift the emphasis away from biophysical sciences to social sciences if we have any hope of meeting this challenge or any challenge. The challenges are so interrelated. We're going to be discussing challenging crises from the viewpoint of Bhagavad Gita, but let's just contemplate more deeply our situation today. I'm reminded of something a climatologist right here at Stanford University said. He's the late Stephen Schneider. He asked a very essential question. Can democracy survive complexity? Now, what does that mean? The various challenges confronting the world, they're like nothing experienced a couple of hundred years ago because the challenges are so interrelated, so interlocked, so multidisciplinary. And unless we can view these challenges in a holistic manner, it seems we just can't get our, we can't, how do you grab the bull by the horns? This is a great challenge. This complexity is a great challenge for our institutions. Institutions that are functioning in such a way that they don't acknowledge anything beyond the next election or the next financial quarter. Is there some way that our institutions can evolve rapidly, evolve their capacity to make better decisions so that our survival is not in jeopardy? I'd like to take things deeper, though, than just the challenge to our institutions. When we look at Bhagavad Gita, we find that the individual is challenged. In other words, institutional challenge means the individual is challenged because institutions are the creation of human beings. So if we actually focus on how human beings are doing as individuals, we'll see the real cause of the institutional challenge. Another Stanfordite coined the famous expression now in 2008, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. One of your economists here, Paul Romer, said that at the beginning of the global financial crisis. Of course, he said that 4 years ago when there was great hope that the crisis would be short-lived. Now, crisis has kind of lost some of its luster and attractiveness as the economic doldrums persist. That's all right. Let's go on with that. Let's run with that ball. A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Bhagavad Gita certainly centers upon such a mantra. If we look at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, we find that there is a massive crisis. A huge feud in an extended family. The feud has culminated into a battle. And it is there on the battlefield in between two armies that Bhagavad Gita is spoken. The scene is quite acute. The scene is quite nerve-wracking for the central character, Arjuna. He's not a military conscript. He's a professional military man by ability, by skill, and by conviction. He abides by a strict code of ethics to only use his military skills, not for resource wars or oil wars, but for maintaining integrity, justice, protecting the innocent. Because in the ancient Vedic culture of India, civilians were never involved in military conflicts, nor were those whose natural ability was not fighting they were never involved. They were never drafted into the military. One had to have that ability and that calling. So Arjuna is finding himself in the midst of a massive crisis. There's no question that the impending battle is necessary for establishing justice. There's no question of that. The problem is that the battle involves family members, friends, former acquaintances, even former teachers. Family members means extended kinship system, not like the nuclear family we know today, but it means distant relations, nevertheless, family. So the battle is taking place among them. One side has been greedy, has been oppressive, exploitative, and Arjuna is opposing that side. So from the standpoint of politics, sociology, he's doing the right thing. But looking at the opposing army, the crisis suddenly hits Arjuna in its full impact. And certainly, this is a crisis that Arjuna would like to waste. He would not like to do anything about it because he sees this is a battle amongst family relations. No matter how extended, still it's family. This is a battle among former friends. I see former military professors who taught me the military art. I see them on the other side, ready to oppose me. You see, in the ancient Vedic system of education, a former teacher of yours is honored and revered like a guru. So it was horrifying for Arjuna to think of facing in combat for family members, former friends, former instructors. Such a sense of honor, such a sense of such character caused him to basically have a breakdown, a psychological breakdown. In this crisis, Arjuna presented that. Why do we have to base everything on politics, economics, sociology? He told Krishna, and of course the central mystery in Bhagavad Gita is who is Krishna? Arjuna told Krishna, why do we have to go on with this battle? I don't really care that much about the politics, the economics, the sociology. Let the other side do whatever they want. I would like to just walk off the battlefield and forget it all. Retire. It's too agonizing to see. Family members, friends, teachers, arrayed against each other. I can't take it. This shouldn't be. I know they're wrong, but if they want to be greedy, so be it. I'd like to just drop my duties and just walk off the battlefield and just retire. This is kind of like, on today's scale, it's kind of like the president of the USA saying, look, I'm tired of all the partisan politics. I'm tired of the media. I'm walking out of the White House. I'm going to be a yoga teacher. It's on par with that. Arjuna's decision not to fight in Bhagavad Gita. And his reasons that he gave to Krishna, that extraordinary, unique personality, Krishna, the excuses that Arjuna gave to Krishna were actually quite brilliant from the economic, sociological, and political point of view. He said, look, We wage this war, even if my side wins, we'll be so devastated internally at all the disruption that the combat will cause. So many men are not going home. They'll be dead on the battlefield. Their families will be disrupted. Who will raise their children? Who will take care of their wives? I can't be responsible for this just because the other side is greedy. Let them be greedy. Let them have whatever they want. I can't be responsible for the breakdown of society that is going to result when this huge battle is finished. I don't want to take the responsibility for that. So in effect, Arjuna is saying to Krishna, let's forget economics, politics, sociology. Let's be religious. Being religious means I just walk off the battlefield with no claims to anything and let everyone, if they want to fight, they can fight, but I'm not involved. I exempt myself. I don't want to be a part of this. I don't see how any good can come out of this battle. No one is going to be happy. I know the other side is greedy. They've done horrible things, and it should be that I stand up for justice. But they're my relatives. They're my former friends, my former teachers. I can't do it. There's every economic, political, and social reason to fight, but I say let's be religious. Let's just be non-involved. Let me retire from the battlefield and live a life of non-involvement. Now, what is Krishna's response in the midst of Arjuna's breakdown? This is a crisis. Arjuna is an extraordinary personality. The way Bhagavad Gita presents Arjuna is that he's of a caliber far beyond human beings today. So his breakdown is quite dramatic. Bhagavad Gita describes that his skin is burning. Tears are filling his eyes. He's having the classic symptoms of nervous breakdown, overwhelmed by the crisis. He makes his final presentation to Krishna. Let's be religious. Let's not be political. Let's not be social. Let's not be economical. Let us be religious. Peace. In Sanskrit, Om Shanti. Just let there be peace. Now, what is Krishna's response? Very interesting. Because Arjuna is saying to Krishna, let's be religious. Let's not be political. Krishna's response is, Arjuna, I don't care about being religious. Let's be scientific. This is shocking in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna actually pushes aside Arjuna's offer to be religious instead of political, and Krishna says, let's be scientific. Arjuna, you're speaking so many words, high-sounding words, well-educated words, erudite words about politics, society, the economy, and then you're even going higher and speaking about religion, but I say you're talking like someone who's not been properly educated. Why? You're not being scientific. How can Bhagavad Gita be presenting such a view? Isn't it one of those religious holy books? How is it that Krishna is pushing aside Arjuna's proposal to be religious, and Krishna is saying, no, you're speaking big words, very erudite words, but you don't know what you're talking about. Let's be scientific. What does Krishna mean by that? He says to Arjuna, why are you so disturbed? Why are you lamenting? You're lacking some essential scientific understanding. You don't know the difference between the body and the self. From this point, Bhagavad Gita gets going. As in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives Arjuna lessons in how the self is non-material. This is quite extraordinary, because Krishna is presenting this understanding of the self as crucial to human well-being. Now you might say, well, why did Krishna jump to that level? Why not just deal with Arjuna's political, social concerns? Even why not deal with Arjuna's religious concerns? Some of you may remember a famous statement by Albert Einstein. A problem is never solved on its own level. You can see that in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna doesn't want to slug it out on the low-level platform of politics, sociology. He doesn't even want to deal on the conventional religious platform of, well, I believe this. What do you believe? Krishna wants to go to a higher level in terms of, let us discuss what actually is the real self. And then we can see what we should be doing in life. Without a clear understanding of what the self is, whether the self is material or non-material, we're not going to understand how we should be responding to the various events in life. So this is how Krishna in Bhagavad Gita takes advantage of the crisis and does not waste the crisis. Arjuna, we'll focus on, again, the character of Arjuna, the personality. In his complete state of breakdown, he presents himself to Krishna. I don't know what I'm doing. I've lost all confidence in myself. I've lost my composure. I'm weak. In this kind of situation I'm in, I'm asking you, can you please give me some instruction? And that instruction by Krishna is all about the non-material nature of the self. Krishna begins that presentation in this crisis by saying, there is something about you that doesn't change, although everything about your body and mind is changing. So this is Bhagavad Gita's non-sectarian stance. What Krishna is indicating is that no matter what you label yourself, you want to label yourself a particular religious belief? Fine. You want to label yourself agnostic, atheist? Fine. You want to label yourself this ethnicity, that ethnicity, male, female? Fine. But what is it about you that doesn't change, although the body and mind are changing? This is Krishna taking things to the scientific platform. Obviously, not everyone's going to agree with Krishna's scientific presentation, but at least we should recognize that the inconceivable brilliance of Krishna's taking the whole crisis to that level and saying, this is the level we have to focus on. Because Arjuna, he's so wrapped up in the impending death of so many soldiers. So people sometimes become confused. They think, why is Krishna disregarding that? Is Bhagavad Gita some kind of cruel, cold book? Arjuna is concerned with the loss of life. And what does Krishna say? You don't have wisdom. You don't have knowledge. You're not being scientific. The body is going to die anyway. You should be concerned with other things. So sometimes people, they misunderstand. They think that Krishna is saying, ignore violence, ignore pain, and just realize that we are not material and we have nothing to do with those material situations. No, that's not what Krishna is saying. He's taking advantage of the crisis. He's not wasting the crisis. He's using the crisis to go to a higher level and saying, there are lower priorities and there are higher priorities. So Arjuna, you're seeing the lower priorities. Even if you don't fight, still you don't. Death is there. The body is changing. So let's talk about what doesn't change, although the body is always changing. So this is Krishna's non-sectarian proposal, that whatever you call yourself, this gender, that gender, this ethnicity, that ethnicity, or mixture of both, as is so common today, this religious persuasion, that religious persuasion, this political affiliation, that political affiliation, regardless, what is it about you that doesn't change, although the body is always changing? This is Krishna's scientific challenge, and it's a challenge that today we still need to take quite seriously, because we have not solved the problem of what is the self. It's very easy to dismiss the self as just a fantasy produced by the brain, but that's a religious statement. There's no proof. It's very easy to say that conscious awareness is something that just emanates from neural activity in the brain. Again, a religious statement. There's no proof. I was speaking at University of Toronto a few days ago, and naturally, there'll be some students who will object out of hand hearing Krishna's presentation of science, that there is something non-material which doesn't change, although the body is changing. So they say, oh, that's that dualism, vitalism. Isn't that old-fashioned? I say, I pointed out to them, this is a judgment. Let's look at things impartially. Okay, you could say it is miraculous that there could be a non-material energy and a material energy, that there could be the physicality of our body, and then it could be something that's non-physical, both coexisting. This sounds very spooky and miraculous. All right, let's grant that, I explained to the students and professors. Let's grant that it's very spooky and miraculous to exist, to admit that there's a non-material reality coexisting with a material reality. All right, that's spooky and miraculous. But isn't it also then spooky and miraculous to posit that from matter arises conscious awareness? That sounds quite miraculous and spooky. And have you ever seen it? Give me a laboratory demonstration, please. So at least we should be impartial. Okay, this one's spooky and the other one's spooky too. So keeping that in mind, we can pursue what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita with a more balanced vision. That maybe what Krishna is saying is not that far out at all. I remind them, for example, I reminded the students in Canada, University of Toronto, that arguably the world's most famous scientist amongst the general population, Stephen Hawking, made the very bold pronouncement. He said, just face it, you're simply chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. Now that's quite miraculous, that from chemical scum arises conscious awareness. This is a bold claim. This is a religious claim. So why not consider Krishna's contrary claim? That, look, begin with common sense, non-sectarian common sense. What is it about you that doesn't change, although your body is always changing? That should let you know that there is something non-material about you. Of course, that doesn't prove anything, that example Krishna gives. He's giving you a strong indication. And then later in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives you the actual spiritual laboratory techniques to verify the existence of the non-material energy. So that is what is quite substantial. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, I want you to believe this. All you have to do is believe. But everywhere in this most essential text, Bhagavad Gita, everywhere Krishna explains that here is the procedure for verifying what I'm saying. So I would consider that's fair enough. In the midst of this greatest crisis that Arjuna is going through, Krishna is saying we've got to solve this crisis at a deeper level. We can't just stay on the same level of the crisis. Now we could overlook Krishna's offers to go to a deeper level, to a non-material level, and we could consider other options. For example, we could decide that in this human crisis of today, in which human psychology evidently has not advanced as much as human technology. You can see that in terms of the human species' impact on the environment, and you can also see it in terms of the weaponry. Now it's not simply nuclear weapons that can finish off everything. Now we also have chemical weapons that can do that. So you have the excessive footprint caused by the development of human technology, and you have the threat to human existence caused by human weaponry. Where has there been the development of human character, human psychology? So many are starting to wonder about this, especially because, as I said earlier, we look at the environmental problems, the social problems, economic problems, and we realize we've got an institutional problem. But the institutional challenges show a human challenge, so much so that you're actually not dealing with scientific problems, you're dealing with social problems. One famous economist said about the current economic difficulties, this is not about economics, this is a moral problem. How can human beings have economic growth in such a way that they don't endanger the Earth planet and the very existence of human beings who live on the earth? This is a moral problem. Okay, so what are our solutions to deal with a moral problem? I was speaking at London School of Business 3 weeks ago, and I was giving them a short encapsulation of Jeffrey Sachs' latest treatise. He's a specialist in the economies of developing nations, but recently he turned his attention to the USA and analyzed the whole socioeconomic situation brilliantly. And in the end, he said, actually, we have a problem in human character. The American public needs to understand, once again, moderation, cooperation, collaboration, virtue. So some news reporters asked him, well, how do they do that? You brilliantly analyzed the whole socioeconomic situation of the USA. You're holding forth at Columbia University. You have your own institute. You're world-renowned for brilliantly analyzing the problems of developing nations. Now you've turned your lens on the USA. Brilliant analysis. And you conclude by saying, the American people need to understand and practice moderation, cooperation, collaboration, modesty, basic virtues. So how do we do that? His answer was, I'm an economist. This is not my department. So this is the problem. What to do about human character, the development of human psychology? Some persons argue that the problems we're having today are because human psychology has evolved to only deal with hunter-gatherer tribal enclaves, in which you were just responsible to a group or cluster of 50 to 100 persons, and you worked out all your social problems in that very, very tiny small village context. Therefore, human personality, because it's still on that developmental level of a hunter-gatherer dealing with a small cluster of nomads living close to the earth, because human personality is still on that level, it can't really consider the concerns of others outside of your immediate circle. Some scholars are arguing like that. You have to face the evolutionary limitations of the human personality. The human personality really is not equipped. It hasn't developed. They say it hasn't evolved to the point where you can consider the welfare of strangers, anyone outside your immediate kinship group, your immediate little hunter-gatherer circle. Moreover, it can't consider things in the far future. It only deals with immediate crises. So since human nature is like that, we can't expect much from it. And that's why we're having so many problems today. The human psychology has not evolved, hasn't developed, yet the technology, the weaponry has developed. What to do? Moral education has been tried. There have been great moral teachers throughout human history. But it seems that human beings really don't walk that talk. And the proof is that the earth is in such a crisis today, environmentally and militarily. So what to do? Why not recognize the inbuilt limitations of the human psychology as it's developed? Don't expect anything more. Because the problems today involve what's called the tragedy of the commons. This is a very conducive model for viewing the wider situation of human society today, the tragedy of the commons. Let's say you have a pasture, a common pasture, which is utilized by a group of sheep herders. So they know that we can't overgraze this pasture. We have to come to an agreement that at a certain point we stop grazing the sheep in order that the pasture can recover. Otherwise, we're all going to suffer. So this model of the tragedy of the commons presents that because it's a small group of sheep herders, it's easy for them to work a deal out. And they can see what everyone else is doing. Therefore, they'll trust. Okay, I'll agree to keep my sheep off. You're going to keep your sheep off? It's for the good of us all. And they can keep their eyes on everyone. No one's sneaking his sheep on at night. They have to trust each other. Otherwise, what happens if just one sheep herder comes to the conclusion, you know, we're really destroying this pasture. This is not good. We're all going to be wiped out in the future. I'll keep my sheep off the pasture. He may have those noble feelings, but what good will it do? He'll lose out both ways. His sheep won't eat, and everyone eventually is going to starve because his other fellow sheep herders, they're allowing their sheep to overgraze. So the noble sheep herder loses both ways, immediately and in the future. Whereas the not-so-bright sheep herders, they seem to gain in the future. Oh, who cares that we're overgrazing the pasture? Look, if you want to be noble, go ahead. You keep your sheep off, but we're going to keep going for it. It seems like they're gaining in the present, but of course everyone loses in the future. So in this tragedy of the commons example, because you're dealing with a small group of people, they all know each other, they can all watch each other, they can come to a deal. But human society today is global, it's complex. You can't keep your eye on everyone. And so therefore, no one wants to make that move. If I keep my sheep off the global scene, how do I know that you're going to keep yours off? I can't trust you. I don't know you. I can't monitor you. The world's too complex. So everyone is just kind of eyeing each other. If you consider each nation like a sheep herder, no, I can't. You keep your sheep off. No, you keep yours off. And this way, no one's making any progress. They're all deadlocked. Because those who believe in the limitations of human psychology in terms of how it's evolved, they say the human personality psychology is not capable of dealing with anything greater than a small circle of persons, any issues beyond the immediate. We're just not wired to do that. So therefore, you find that some scholars are increasingly recommending that since moral education doesn't work, religion's been around for thousands of years, and people really don't become that altered from it. Politics can't work because politics is based on the human personality. And the human personality has those limitations, as we've described. The political system just reflects the limitations of the individual human character. So what could save the day? And what would resolve this crisis? And even it's far-fetched, but we've got to use everything at our disposal to deal with such impending human disaster due to environmental reasons, due to military reasons. What could save the day? Biochemical moral enhancement. That since human beings are chemical and chemically driven in their brain, we have nothing to lose by our administering appropriate neurochemicals to modify human behavior. Nothing to lose, everything to gain. Now, The argument goes, you may be shocked about this. Oh my gosh, who could consider such a thing? But the proponents already point out that it's already happening. Psychiatric drugs are administered to correct chemical imbalances in the brain. So why not just take things further? We have nothing to lose in this crisis. Why not use all the facilities at our command? And with knowledge of the brain and the chemistry in the brain, we might be able to assist moral education by proper biochemical moral enhancement. We propose, though, that Krishna's processes given in Bhagavad Gita are much more effective. The problem that hits you first with biochemical moral enhancement is, and even the propagators of this admit, they say most likely the persons who are advancing this science of biochemical moral enhancement, they are the ones most in need. They're the ones most in need of the biochemicals to straighten them out. So they said, that is a problem. But we have everything to gain and nothing to lose by trying. Because what else? Politics is not working. Our institutions are not designed to handle such complex, interlocking, interwoven challenges. Moral education hasn't really slowed people down. So why not use the cutting edge of science to possibly make a difference? Nothing to lose, everything to gain. What do you think? Now, what is Krishna's solution in Bhagavad Gita? I hope you're understanding now why, when Arjuna presented the crisis to Krishna, Krishna certainly didn't waste the crisis. He took the problem to a higher level for solution and said, you're missing the point here. We are not matter. The real living entity is non-material, wearing the body just like someone wears clothes. Unless you understand this, you'll always be overwhelmed by material intricacy. In fact, you'll always be overwhelmed by illusion. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna defines illusion as you're thinking you're something that you're not. Roughly speaking, like the driver of the car thinking that he or she is the car, identifying with the car. And when the car, you press a button and your seat gets warm, you know, oh, that feels good, that's me. So similarly, when the body is having what we call nice physical pleasures, we identify with that. Oh, it feels good, that's me, I feel good. And the reverse, when someone bangs into your car, you think, they hit me, I feel pain. So this is the beginning of what Krishna calls illusion. This is the preliminary definition of illusion in Bhagavad Gita. Misidentification of the self as the body and the mind. Very interesting. As long as this misidentification problem is not solved, the living entity remains an illusion. And therefore, based on a mistaken understanding of the self, thinking the body and mind are the self, your goals are mistaken. Your ambitions, your desires are mistaken. And the problems of human life just compound on the individual level, on the societal level. So Krishna in Bhagavad Gita traces the problems back to this root, misidentification of the self as being matter. So remember, Arjuna, in the beginning, he was saying to Krishna, let's not be sociological. Let's not be political. Let's not be economic. Let's be religious. War is bad. I'm out of here. I'm walking off the battlefield. They can have it all. They can be greedy. I don't care. Let's be religious. And what does Krishna say? Let's be scientific. You're speaking big words of politics, social science. You're even speaking big words about religion as conventionally understood. I'm not interested. Let's be scientific. What is the nature of the self? So bhakti yoga recognizes that the big challenge, the real crisis facing human society today is, what is the identity of the self? The fact that consciousness is so bewildering lets us know that there is something that can't be understood about the self in terms of physical science. There's something more to the self. But we want to verify that. Where do we get the laboratory techniques to verify that? That's the value of Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is inviting us into the bhakti laboratory. Here's what you do. You apply your senses in this way, this is the result you'll get. This is why Bhagavad Gita remains such an extraordinarily attractive text. Again, nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna ask you to believe this, I'm saying it, believe it. Everywhere is procedure. So that is how Krishna responds to the crisis Arjuna has got himself into. And in this way, Bhagavad Gita remains an essential text for human well-being. Of course, perhaps we might find Bhagavad Gita too esoteric for us. Then there's always the biochemical moral enhancement. Recognizing the perennial limitations of human psychology, which in turn produce limitations in our political systems. Recognize human beings can't see beyond the immediate future. They can't really consider the interests of those outside of their immediate circle. Effectively, they can't do that. Theoretically, they can, but effectively. Just like, for example, consider climate change. Just one of the challenges facing human beings today, but just consider that. The average human being cannot motivate himself, herself, to respond to a crisis that will really kick in and affect future generations, people in distant lands, and animal species that you don't even know. You're not even aware of those species. How can you motivate the average human being to make a sacrifice based on that? Unborn generations, distant peoples in other parts of the world, and animal species that you've never even heard of their names before. So the moral biochemical enhancement people, they say, look, face it, you can't get human beings motivated. They're just not. They haven't developed that way. They're not sufficiently advanced. Their technology's advanced, their weaponry's advanced, but the human psychology's not advanced. So what's wrong with a little help? A little help from technology. The very technology that's gotten us into a big problem can also be used to get us out of the problem. And we got nothing to lose. I prefer the solutions in Bhagavad Gita. How to produce wisdom, controlled mind and senses, a spiritually flourishing life based on understanding the non-material nature of the self. And remember, Krishna's definition of illusion is, the core definition of illusion is, our thinking we are matter. And therefore we think, to satisfy myself, I need material arrangements. So this is Bhagavad Gita's core presentation of what illusion is. Not only is the nature of illusion presented, but also how to get out of that illusion. How do we get out of that illusion? According to Bhagavad Gita, we take our designs and plans from the source of all energy, and then we don't have to rely on our limited intelligence. In other words, Bhagavad Gita recognizes that there's limited consciousness and there's unlimited consciousness, and it proposes a relationship between the two. So this is Krishna's presentation to Arjuna. Krishna is saying, Arjuna, you are limited consciousness. I am unlimited consciousness. We're meant to function together, just like the part functions with the whole. You forget about me, then you're an illusion, thinking you're the body, you're the mind. You listen to me, follow my techniques, you come out of illusion, and then you can actually see how to benefit yourself and all living entities. Because you're my part. You are the finite, I am the infinite. So, in conclusion, Bhagavad Gita is focusing us on the level of consciousness as distinct from matter. This is the challenge of Bhagavad Gita. I thank you all very much for your kind attention.